I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:18 on Tuesday, April 8th, 2025. We are here in room 120, and please silence your cell phones today. Our members present today include Representative Vance, Representative Moore, Representative Holland, had just joined us and will be right back, Representative Himshut, and myself, Chair Carrick. Our record secretary today is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juno LAO is Emma Turner, and our committee aide today is my staff, Stuart Relay. On today's agenda, we have four bills. We will start with House Bill 104 from Representative Mears on an address confidentiality program for an introductory hearing. We will then take up House Bill 58 from Representative Fields' office on a public advocate appointment, and then House Bill 35 for consideration of amendments from Representative Himshut. Finally, as time allows today, we will also take up House Bill 139 from Representative Stapp's office on renting the governor's mansion. So to get started today, I'd like to invite Representative Mears to the table and her staff, Talia, if they'd like to introduce yourselves, and please proceed with your introductory presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the State Affairs Committee, for hearing this bill today. For the record, my name is Donna Mears, and I have the privilege to represent the great people of House District 21, South Muldoon, and East Anchorage. I am joined by my staff, Talia Ames. There's a small but important group of people in the state that have reasons to keep their address out of the public record. This includes peace officers and correctional officers who may be targets of retribution due to their roles in the justice system. It also includes victims of domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault, and other people who have protective orders. The purpose of a program like this is to allow someone who faces these serious threats to be able to participate fully in everyday life without further endangering themselves or their family. House Bill 104 creates an address protection program for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence, peace officers and correctional officers, and their families. There are many times an address must be provided in order to participate in society. This includes voting, working, sending children to school, and much more. HB 104 establishes a program whereby these at-risk individuals can receive mail at an anonymized P.O. box. Mail received by the state on behalf of enrollees will be forwarded to the participant's home address, which shall remain confidential. Ms. Ames is available to read the sectional.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Talia Ames, staff to Representative Mears. And the short section one adds the program to the duties of the Department of Administration. Section two creates the program. B requires a post office box as a substitute mailing address for enrollees and instructs the department to forward mail to participants. It charges the department with protecting confidentiality and requires regulations to govern enrollment and withdrawal. Section 2C describes eligible participants as people sheltered by a protective order and their parents, guardians, children, and household members. It also admits peace officers and correctional officers. 2D prevents registered sex offenders from enrolling in the program. 2E requires state and municipal agencies to accept the P.O. box. 2F describes the eligibility period. 2G prevents the department from charging a fee. 2H allows access to confidential addresses subject to a search warrant. 2I establishes penalties for unlawfully revealing a protected individual's address. 2J defines certain terms. Section 3 establishes a transition period for the department to adopt regulations to implement the program. Section 4 lets the department begin promulgating regulations immediately. And finally, Section 5 sets an effective date to January 1st, 2026 for the rest of the bill.
And just before we get to questions, I want to make clear that this is a program for folks that are already doing a lot of things to protect their address and their whereabouts. So they're already moving, changing their address in other ways and putting up other processes in their lives in order to keep their location confidential. One of the situations I was thinking about when we were working on this bill was that Alaska's got a lot of small communities. So if you've got someone that is fleeing a situation and they move to a small community, if they have a P.O. box, you'd think in a lot of situation that provides a lot of anonymity with a personal P.O. box. But if you're in a small town, going to a small post office box, even knowing what town you're in, could be risky for someone. So this helps anonymize that process to help protect folks.
Thank you, Representative Mears. We do have a couple of invited testifiers online. I'd like to go to them and then go to questions from the committee. Just one invited testifier, Ms. Keely Olson with Standing Together Against Rape from Anchorage. If you can hear us and if you could just put yourself on the record, please go ahead and provide your testimony.
Hello, this is Keely Olson. I am the executive director of STAR, or Standing Together Against Rape, and have been for the last 10 years here in Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 104. I consider it a critical piece of legislation and would welcome an address confidentiality program in Alaska. Prior to my work at STAR, I have had the experience of being a victim advocate within a prosecuting attorney's office in Washington State, and I managed their domestic violence shelter program in Missoula, Montana. Both states have address confidentiality programs and have for decades. We use them as essential tools to assist someone with stalking or highly felony risk to be safer. Combined with comprehensive safety planning and an emergency relocation plan, which is for those of you who are not in the know, that is kind of a common proceeding for someone who is trying to escape a stalker, someone who will not let them go, someone who is following them, making contact with their workplace, their school, their children's schools, in violation of protective orders. Helping them to determine how they can make a safe move and keep their address confidential is really, really critical. I believe that an address confidentiality program can help save lives and help survivors cope with the constant fear of their location being compromised that I've witnessed. Address confidentiality programs are available in at least 40 states. The programs I have experienced with are accessible, easy to use, and inexpensive or free to a victim, survivor. Out of curiosity, I contacted Montana's program administrator to ask about their program. And it explained to me that over the last 17 years, the program has cost a minimal amount per year to operate. They have 68 participants enrolled at the time that I contacted them. And the main cost of the program were to pay a small portion of the program administrator's salary and her assistant salary so that they would always have redundancy if one of them were out of the office, that the other one would be able to handle an email that came in. One thing I would note is that, these programs are not like a free mail service that folks would generally want to take advantage of just to keep their address confidential if they didn't have a need to escape stalking or harassment. There is a delay in getting your mail, of course. You may not receive any periodicals. You wouldn't receive mailers like we get, mailers with coupons and those kinds of things. Those generally do not get transferred. A lot of people that I know have lost their magazine subscriptions and the like. So it's not something that people really would jump to do, but when other things have failed, and some people have maybe had moves over a couple of different times, they're happy to have it at their disposal. I really applaud making programs accessible to law enforcement. I've worked with those in law enforcement who place their homes in a spouse or family member's name to keep their address confidential. So I can appreciate the need for their inclusion in the bill. Thank you again to the sponsor and for the opportunity to testify and comment in support. I greatly appreciate all your work to increase safety for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And I'm available for any questions.
Great. Thank you very much. We do have a second invited testifier who has just joined us, and that would be Randy McClellan with the Alaska Correctional Officers Association in Eagle River. Before we go to his testimony, I'll note that Representative McCabe has just joined us. Mr. McClellan, if you could put yourself on the record and provide your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Randy McClellan. As you said, I'm the president of the Alaska Correctional Officers Association. I'm also a staff sergeant with the Department of Corrections. I've been the president of ACOA for about 15 years, and I've been with the Department of Corrections going on 28 years now. I'm calling today in support of House Bill 104. Alaska has over 980 correctional officers serving in 13 correctional facilities throughout the state. And unfortunately, threats and attacks on correctional officers is commonplace in our facilities. Correctional officers are the last line of defense between dangerous criminals and innocent Alaskans, making them the target of many ill-intentioned offenders. Correctional officers are trained and encouraged to take many precautions in order to preserve the privacy of their personal information. A correctional officer's greatest fear, frankly, is a dangerous offender or offender who has made threats to them and their family, seeking revenge, paying his or her family a visit while they're working or away on other trip. That would be, that's probably every correctional officer's worst nightmare, actually. I, myself, have had my personal information compromised in the past. I was working in a maximum custody unit at Cook Inlet pretrial some years ago where a violent inmate had been making threats toward my family and I for well over a week, claiming he would pay us a visit and, or have somebody else do it if he couldn't, promising to do numerous heinous things that I won't repeat here today on this phone line. And, you know, they are always fearful, but you feel like the system has got your back, so as long as you're taking precautions, you feel safe. One day I was passing by his cell, and he signaled me as I passed by the window, and he planted a piece of paper on the glass window, showing me a printout of my personal information, including my home address. And he simply stared at me laughing and nodding his head in confirmation. And honestly, this made me, and I was newer in my career at the time, but this made me extremely fearful and probably overly cautious with my family for many, many years to come. Alaska is one of only a handful of states, to my knowledge, who have no address protection program for law enforcement. And it's my opinion that this legislation would be a powerful tool to help protect correctional officers, law enforcement at large, and their families. And I fully support it. Thank you all for all you do to help keep public safety officers in Alaska safe. And if anybody has any questions, I am more than happy to answer.
Great. Thank you, Mr. McClellan, for your testimony. And at this time, I think we can open it up for some questions. I think Representative Holland was in the queue.
Thank you, through the chair. Just learning about this bill and about this program, and I appreciate also the details I found in the fiscal notes explaining some background of the programs in other states. There's a lot of very helpful information. I'm just curious generally about the method in which this is able to work with people where they have to still supply some sort of physical address. I'm assuming that for getting a library card or utilities or, in our state, potentially permanent fund or voter registration. It seems like there's places where we still have to put a physical address, you know, down in order to get something done. And I'm just wondering how that works for somebody that enrolls in this program that gives them the ability to both have the protections that this program entails but also access to other programs or activities that might require a physical address being disclosed. Thanks.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Mears. I believe Ms. Ames might have more details, but this is just one of a number of things. So there's privacy protection built into a lot of other systems. So this helps add another layer for those systems that don't have protected confidentiality options.
Through the chair, to Representative Holland, Talia Ames, for the record. So Section 2E makes it so the state or municipal agency would have to accept the post office box used. And when you actually need a physical address, such as the instance of registering to vote, we actually have an example of the voter registration form, but there's a box that you can check that will keep it confidential. I think those are about the times you might need a physical address.
Helpful. Thank you.
And I'll go to Representative McCabe in a moment. I had a question, too, about how it's been referenced that most states or maybe all states have some sort of address confidentiality, at least for law enforcement. Do we know how many states have something like that?
To the chair, Talia Ames, for the record. It's actually the opposite. The last I recall, we'll find out for sure, but it is, I think there are 5 states that don't have something along these lines, and most states actually have this for those who've been victims of domestic violence. A lot of them don't include LEOs and peace officers. So Alaska would be doing something a little different from the majority in that respect.
And as a follow-up, so many states don't include LEOs or police officers. And so who is included typically?
To the chair, the domestic violence victims are usually, Brenda Stanfill is here, and she has more information on from the advocate's point of view, if you'd like to ask her.
I am thinking that might be helpful if Brenda Stanfill would come forward. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. For the record, Brenda Stanfill. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I can't answer the question about how many include any type of law enforcement or correctional officer. Most of the address confidentiality programs that are across the nation are focused on domestic violence and sexual assault stalking victims. That is, in many ways, how it started. And so this one does include more than what you would see in most states. Does that answer your question?
It does, okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to get a sense of how this policy looks in other places. Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So what about property owners and tax rolls? So a correctional officer or peace officer owns a home in the valley, frankly. I've actually had pretty bad experience with this myself. There's a way in the borough where you can take yourself off of the computer, but they can still go to the borough itself and request your information and get your address from that if you own property. I wonder how that would be taken care of. It doesn't appear like it's, would they be able to take you off of the tax rolls because this guy claims that those tax rolls are supposed to be public knowledge so that he can do things like file a claim to have them go assess your property. So in my case, but in a peace officer's case, if somebody was looking for him, a corrections officer, they could find it that way, right? I mean, are those records public? How would you contemplate fixing that?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, this does not stop that. This situation is more for people that may be establishing a new domicile or, are fleeing violence. A lot of times the example of domestic violence victims is used. there's a possibility of establishing a trust in which to register your home in order to keep it completely off the books. And as you mentioned, certain municipalities do have programs established. I know that Anchorage Muni has a confidentiality program for property taxes that we're looking into, but that unfortunately would need to be handled at the muni level.
Thanks.
And Representative Himshute.
Thank you, through the chair. The max year, the sixth year, has 300 participants. What kind of numbers, how many troopers, how many local police officers, how many VPSOs are in the state? And then on top of that, how many people are served by victim services? And I'm asking for very detailed numbers here, but it feels like 300. So I'm assuming this is a lifetime program. Once you're in, this is an annual PO box fee would fall to the state. So there'd be upfront costs with the ID and all that. But then the state would be paying annually for a post office box for, looks like we're capping this at 300, but is that the real number? Or would it continue to grow after the sixth year?
I'd like to briefly address the longevity. People might not necessarily be in it on a lifetime. There's so many different circumstances. There's plans, right, that people come up with as victims that they're going through, and some of those are shorter term in nature, kind of depending what's happening with the offender. And I think Ms. Ames has got some more information on numbers and program participation.
Through the chair, so those numbers were generated from other programs, and Keely Olson does know a little bit about those. If you'd like to refer the question to her, with the exception of the peace officers, she's got more familiarity with the program actually running, and it's something that, of course, Alaska, we're different than everywhere else, so it could potentially look different, but she'd have a more concrete example.
Let's go to Ms. Keely Olson. If you can hear us, you might be muted on your side. Maybe not. We'll give it another moment if you can.
Exactly right. This is.
There we go.
This is Keely Olson with STAR. You're exactly right. I was muted on my end. My apologies. I believe the question was about the numbers of people.
Correct.
Was that?
Yes.
I'm not sure I heard the question correctly.
Perhaps Representative Himshute can restate the question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Olson, my question is about after 6 years, this caps out at 300 participants. And I just was wanting to understand more about the number 300. And when I think about how many VPSOs, community police officers, troopers, et cetera, it feels like that number combined with people served by victim services is going to be higher. So can you say anything about possible participants? And then my second question had to do with, is this a lifetime program? And I think I understand now some people might need it for a lifetime. Other people might only need it for a year or two. So there would be some variability there.
Yes, Representative, through the chair, Representative Hemshit, I was curious about that myself when I contacted Montana, because I feel like they have sort of a similar rural population to Alaska, and so it was kind of surprising to me to find out that after 17 years of operating that they had only 68 people using the service, and they said generally, they didn't get mail for them on a regular basis. It was for specific purposes where they were at risk of their address being made public, such as, voting records and those sorts of things, that they wanted to use a confidential address. But they weren't using it for all of their mail over time. and some of them had fallen off and weren't using it at all. So I don't know that it is something that I believe that it probably is time sensitive, and I believe that a lot of people who may qualify for it won't use it. That it is not as efficient as walking out to your mailbox or stopping by your post office on your way home to get your mail, right? It's delayed, first of all. So it really is for, and I, as a victim advocate, would counsel people about the pros and cons of the program, what it could do and what it couldn't do, and help them understand that maybe some of the things that they wanted it to do, it would not do. and that helps to wean people from a knee-jerk response of thinking, like, this is a new program, I need to take advantage of it. It definitely is not for everyone. And I don't mean to say that it is objectively made more difficult to use to wean people off of it. I'm just saying that it's not meant for everyone. But if you're in a situation of life or death, or you feel like your family is at risk because you've been getting a lot of threats, then it is something that you would want to avail yourself of and take advantage of, with all the cons that go with the pros.
Okay, thank you.
And Ms. Eames.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Hemshute. Just for clarification, the mail forwarding would be more for those pieces of mail where you're creating an official record. So, for example, perhaps you enroll your children in school, you use this P.O. box. It's a centralized P.O. box, so it's not every person getting a separate mailbox. The Department of Administration already receives a lot of mail. They have a great system. Why not use that one, right? So the mail that would be going to these boxes would not be like Amazon packages and whatnot. So, and this is also, as Representative Mears stated earlier, more for people that are kind of almost off the grid, trying to hide themselves, where they don't have social media. They're really, really trying to keep things private in that way. It wouldn't be that many people, we believe.
Thank you.
And I'll just note for the record that Vice Chair Story has joined us. And do we have additional questions on House Bill 104? Seeing none from the committee, I'm going to thank Rep. Mears and your staff for joining us. And to our invited testifiers, thank you very much for testifying on this bill. At this time, we are going to move to the next item on today's agenda, which is House Bill 58 on the Office of Public Advocate appointment from Representative Fields. We did, on Saturday, March 29th, set an amendment deadline for House Bill 58 for Wednesday, April 2nd at 5 p.m. and received no amendments. I will note that Representative Fields is in the room with us today. Is there any additional discussion or question on House Bill 58? Seeing none, and seeing no further discussion, Vice Chair Story, you got here at just the right time. Could I please have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House Bill 58, also known as 34-LS0011/A, be moved from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And seeing no objection, House Bill 58 is moved from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease. House State Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 35 on prisoner tablets from Representative Himshute. At our hearing on Saturday, March 29th, we did set an amendment deadline for House Bill 35 of Monday, April 7th at 5 p.m. and received two amendments. I want to note for committee members that we do have April Wilkerson from Department of Corrections in the room for questions. And we do have Representative Himshute and staff as well. So at this time, I'm going to move Amendment G.2. I am going to move Amendment Number 1, also known as G.2, and I'm going to object for discussion. So House Bill 35 relates to offering new opportunities for inmates in Alaska's correctional system by receiving certain services on tablets. And in hearing this bill in the previous legislature, and I want to thank Representative Vance for bringing that forward in the previous legislature, and in hearing it again this year, a consistent potential clarification has come up for me related to clarifying that these tablets are meant to be provided for addition and not substitution of services that are currently provided in person. We did see during COVID a lot of services move from in-person to online or remote format for the immediate public health issues at hand within DOC. I do think that for those who were able to tour Lemon Creek Correctional Facility a couple weeks ago, or who have had a chance to go into one of our facilities, it is noteworthy that in many of our aging facilities, there are portions of that facility that had been built but are not currently being utilized for the services that they were originally intended for due to very real concerns in the Department of Corrections that they're doing whatever they can to address, but usually relate to low staffing and an increased inmate population, etc. However, it remains that many in-person services that had been or should be available for inmates are not as available and accessible, perhaps, as they once were. And one of my concerns with the legislation as currently written is that there is the potential for these new devices to be used in substitution of currently provided in-person services. So Amendment G2, in short, simply specifies that these tablets may not be used as a substitution for in-person visitation, receiving mail, which is currently photocopied and then provided to inmates, receiving medical services, or other in-person communications. I want these to be another tool in DOC's tool chest and offering inmates something that they don't currently have access to, which I think is very meaningful and important. And we heard testimony to that effect. I look to the committee for potential questions on the amendment. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand the intent behind this, because I believe that you brought this forward last year as well. But just the way this is worded, I have questions. Will this prohibit someone from having visitation across the state, for instance? They can't utilize in person based upon geography, but they want to have a visitation via the tablet that's on the other side of the state. So just for clarification for the record, would this prohibit that activity?
I'm the chair. So used to not doing that. That's only Tuesday. Representative Vance, no. So this would not, if the service is not currently available in person or because there is a remote factor, then you would be able to have the tablet for communication. But a real life example that my office did discuss with Department of Corrections would be potentially an inmate at a facility has to go to a hearing in Anchorage. the inmate would be able, with this language, to have the option to attend via a tablet if that service were available via a tablet, which initially might not be the case. But they wouldn't be required to do so, which I think is a really critical distinction. In other words, if that individual had the option to do in-person, they would be able to choose that in-person service. And that doesn't apply if it's not something that's available currently. So currently, DOC cannot fly out individuals for in-person visitation. So this doesn't open a door towards that. But it just simply says that, for example, if you're at Fairbanks Correctional Facility and your family is in Fairbanks, you could not, DOC could not tell an inmate that we're not going to have in-person visitation anymore because these tablets exist.
I appreciate the you know, putting this on the record. I just want to make sure that it's not that the intent is very clear behind this, that is allowing options. Follow up to this is, does the commissioner still have the flexibility for security reasons to, and maybe health reasons, to say we're only doing visitation via tablet for a certain period of time? You know, like COVID, for instance, they stopped in-person visitation. My opinion, I think they extended it longer than they should have. However, there was clearly a period of time that the tablets allowed for communication that was very necessary. So does the way that this is written allow the commissioner the flexibility to make those decisions as needed?
I think that'd be a good question for April Wilkerson. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. For the record, April Wilkerson with the Department of Corrections, Deputy Commissioner. Through the chair to Representative Vance, through our conversations, our understanding and the intent is to not prohibit and eliminate in-person visitation because the tablets are there. I appreciate the getting it on the record that it would be an option. So if our understanding currently is if visitation, in-person visitation, was not available because of staffing levels or security concerns, that the tablets are a viable option to allow visitations to continue, as long as in-person visitation was not eliminated as being an option moving forward. It would be a substitution on a case-by-case basis.
And I would just follow that up to say that is also my understanding of this language, and my intent is to not necessarily prohibit in a situation like COVID, should God forbid that happen again, in our facilities, DOC's flexibility to make that sort of emergency determination, but as a standard course of practice, that we don't say take current in-person educational opportunities and say, well, because of low staffing and because we have tablets, that's just not going to be available anymore. And that was part of the discussion on this amendment. I'd like to ask Representative Himshut to weigh in since it is your bill.
Thank you for that opportunity, Chair Carrick. And I'll just say that we discussed this amendment with the department, and with all of those understandings that are now on record, I'm comfortable with this amendment. In fact, we had something similar to it previously in the bill, and I think it serves the purpose to clarify exactly what we want, which is these are to supplement, not supplant, as much as possible.
Thank you for that, Representative Himshut. Are there additional questions or discussion? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number one. Is there additional objection? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1, also known as G.2, has been adopted. And at this time, we will move to Amendment Number 2, also known as G.3, Representative Vance.
Move Amendment Number 2.
And I will object for discussion, Representative Vance.
Thank you. This amendment is addressing a gap for those working hard in reentry. It ensures that if a prisoner is eligible for electronic monitoring and is willing to cover the full cost of private monitoring program, the commissioner shall designate a person to serve their sentence through private monitoring, even if they live outside of the DOC service area. So this issue came up in my district. I'm going to share just a brief story. Constituent came to me and said, hey, I'm doing everything to reintegrate into society after incarceration. He's holding down a steady job. He's actively involved in his church and support community. He's paying for his own private electronic monitoring out of pocket. And more than that, he's mentoring others through a local ministry and helping them stay on the right path. He completed his program in rehabilitation to be free from addiction that was causing, you know, more crime. And, you know, he's well on the path to becoming a very productive member of society. So he's our success story. He's taken full responsibility of his life, fulfilling the requirement placed on him by Department of Corrections. But despite of that, the department is telling him that he must move out of the Homer area up to Kenai within their service zone. So they said he needs to leave his job, his church, his home, because his address falls outside of the region that DOC itself provides electronic monitoring. So this amendment just clarifies that the commissioner can, that he is allowed under the commissioner's oversight to still live within the area. He has electronic monitoring that has been approved by the department, but he doesn't have to uproot out of the community to the department's service area. So I found out that this is impacting obviously more than one individual, and I've been trying to find a solution with corrections so that he can remain successful. Without this clarification, he has appeared before a judge numerous times who gave him a waiver that said you can continue to live within your community because you're doing all the right things. However, the department contested that he needed to move up to Kenai to be within their service area directly, and it's requiring him to get a new job, find a new place to live, get a vehicle, and not be within his community of support. So this amendment is just saying, if you look on page 1, line 17, number 1, the prisoner resides outside of an area where electronic monitoring is provided by the department. It's saying, hey, he's meeting all the criteria, he's paying for it, but he can continue to do that. So it's clarifying the statute that's there that says that he can continue to do that because he's already still under supervision with electronic monitoring. I'm just trying to provide a solution that allows people who are doing all the right things to not have to uproot their lives to be in a more narrowed service area because of the Department of Corrections limitations and still be productive members of society and help them succeed where they're at. And I have my staffer, Bob Ballinger, is here to provide any background insight onto how we came to the conclusion of this amendment.
I'm going to look to see committee questions. And if folks do have questions for staff, please feel free to state that. We'll go to Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I think this question is probably for Ms. Wilkerson, actually. And I actually have a couple of them, if that's all right, Chair.
That's all right. Yeah, thank you for being here, April Wilkerson.
Yeah. So, Ms. Wilkerson, so I know from being on the Finance Subcommittee the last 4 years before this one, Electronic monitoring is a big cost for you guys, or significant cost anyways. But I'm wondering if you can tell me why an area is established such as Kenai, but not doesn't include Homer. Does it have to do with the ability to monitor the ankle, or does it just have to do with the ability to send somebody to get the guy if he's not where he's supposed to be?
For the record, this is April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, through the chair to Representative McCabe. In this particular situation, what happened is we did have prior sentenced electronic monitoring services in the Homer area. That was handled through the community jail program by the local police department. They elected to eliminate that, and we didn't have resources to be able to respond timely and efficiently. So in this particular case, that was one of the elements that led to the situation that the representative was referring to. I would also add that we are reevaluating the sentenced electronic monitoring program. We do allow individuals to elect to go on to private electronic monitoring at their own cost. In certain situations, such as their first-time DUI, we're reevaluating that. The commissioner has asked, because of the situation, to see what other elements. There was some concern with how do we account for time served if that individual is serving their whole time on a private electronic monitoring program. So those are some of the elements that we're trying to address.
Thanks. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So what about a private contractor? I mean, what about like the help I've fallen and I can't get up people and they take on something like this in an area where you don't have necessarily state coverage or state LEO, Homer LEO coverage, but now you have a private firm that does security and they do all these other things. And is that kind of what we're talking about with a private monitoring thing?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, that's my understanding, but I would defer to the maker of the amendment to clarify and confirm.
I'm seeing nods.
The recorder can't hear a nod.
I'm waiting for permission through the chair, Representative McCabe. I believe the answer is yes.
Okay. That's what I was trying to get at is how, I mean, sorry, a little bit of comment follow-up, but my, if he's responsible to pay for it, does he have to pay for a new company, or is there a company contractor or some method already in place?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, there are a few private providers that do provide this kind of service.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Holland. I'll go to you, and then I'll go to Vice Chair Story.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, I think to Ms. Wilkerson, but perhaps to the maker of the amendment. So I've got two questions here. One is this section E at line 16 seems like is the core part of the amendment, providing this private contractor option for people that are then outside existing districts. But I'm a little confused because it sounds like we already have private contractors to do this work. So I'm trying to figure out what's really new about this in terms of what this is adding that the department can't already do in terms of private contractors to provide service in different areas. So that's kind of part one of the question. The second is, it sounds like maybe, but this is a question, is do we have existing controls and criteria for who can be a private contractor? So two parts is, it almost seems like this is already done and available. And the second part is, if this is something new about bringing on new people that we don't already have, is there statutes or something that says who can do this and what criteria?
They're entrepreneurs.
Touche. Nicely done.
I'm going to ask Bob Ballinger to please put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's office. The answer to your first question is they can do this already. So what this amendment does is it requires them to do this if there are certain requirements and so forth. So A of this code section is something the legislature put together in order to provide for the opportunity for private monitoring as a cost-saving mechanism, and especially in some places in the state where it's difficult for Department of Corrections to reach. Currently, the commissioner can do that. What this says is if it's a situation where it is outside their service area and they're willing to cover the costs associated with it, the commissioner and they're qualified. So what's important is, you know, subsection B sets out the qualifications that a person must have, then the commissioner will make this requirement. And there's internal policy that the Department of Correction has that limits their ability. If they stick to that policy, they don't change the policy, limits their ability to serve this individual and multiple other individuals who are similarly situated. And the answer to the second part of your question was, were you asking, are there providers out there now? Is that?
Yeah, through the chair, I just was trying to clarify this term here, a private contractor. Is there criteria always defines who gets to do that, other than entrepreneurs that will have the flexibility to do something new? Thank you, Representative. But I just was curious about criteria and existing statute that defined who could fill this role.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ballinger, Representative Vance's office, to Representative Holland. Yes, there is a criteria. They got to be certified currently now. That they got to be approved by the Department of Correction. And we haven't changed that. I wish I could give you the code section, but it's already in code.
Thank you. Good enough for now. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. And Representative Hemshoot, again, as the amendment relates to your legislation, if you could comment on amendment number two.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I'm really struggling with this because I see the situation and I want a remedy, but we already have to change the title to accommodate this amendment, so we're straying a little bit away from what the bill actually does, and so I just need to go back and understand, maybe from Mr. Ballinger through the chair, if all of this is possible right now, what happens? Maybe actually it's Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson. I'm not sure. What happens if somebody is not where they're supposed to be, if the ankle monitor shows that they are not where they're supposed to be? What happens now in that situation? I don't know who can answer it.
Through the chair, it's Representative Hemshoot. I'll take a shot at it. Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's office. So currently, he's being monitored, and if he goes to some location that is not allowed. In fact, the way this came to our attention was he was wanting to have the ability to attend church, and that wasn't listed. And so his provider said, you know, it's not listed. So we got it clarified and got it worked out that he could attend church. And so that's, you know, they will monitor, and if they see him someplace he's not supposed to be, they'll turn him in. And so if he's in violation of his parole, of course, it depends on how bad the judge thinks his parole is violated. Will depend whether he goes back into corrections or whether he gets fined or whatever the remedy is, I guess, or the punishment is.
Follow up. Thank you, through the chair. So when you say he gets picked up or whatever, I'm going to say he, because in this case we know who the person is. So he violates where he's supposed to be. The monitor says out of the zone or in a place where the person's not supposed to be. Then the local police department comes and picks him up.
Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's office, through the chair, to Representative Hemshoot. My guess is it will depend on what the violation is. So if he is in some location that is way off from what he's allowed to do, my guess is local law enforcement would respond if they feel like it's a crime that needs to be enforced. I think that the report would go to his parole officer. And so the parole officer would make a decision about what would happen at that point.
And that's, I guess, my concern, because there are different places the person shouldn't be that have different levels of concern. And so if the person isn't supposed to be in a particular neighborhood where someone lives and they're there, you need an immediate response. So just reporting it wouldn't be adequate. So this is going a little bit deeper than I feel like I'm prepared to go in the bill. So for that reason, I think I would love to see this come back as an actual bill, not as an amendment. But I'm just feeling like I'm struggling to fully understand the scope of what this could change because of my lack of understanding of EM. And so I'm not able at the moment to support this, even though conceptually I would like to solve this problem.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, and I think this is for Ms. Wilkerson. So through the chair, well, I guess I don't have to say that. Do I have to say that?
Yes,
through the chair, Ms. Wilkerson. So currently, if he is inside your area and you have somebody there and he is somewhere where he's not supposed to be, so it's a DV thing or something and he's not supposed to be at his ex-wife's house, what do you do? You just call the cops, I assume, right?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, that is correct. We will coordinate depending on the violation. The monitoring services notifies our on-call or our standby officer. We will coordinate with local law enforcement or the nearest law enforcement to have that individual potentially picked up, or we will make contact and have them report first thing in the morning.
Follow-up? Yeah, so it's no different for your area in Kenai, as it would be in Homer with a contractor. You still have to involve the police because you don't obviously have Department of Corrections officers standing by there on call, you know, on some sort of a ready to go get this guy. It all flows through law enforcement.
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, for the moment, yes.
Okay, thanks.
I just want to note that Senator Myers joined us at 4:15 p.m. Mm-hmm. Welcome. Vice Chair Story, and then we'll go to Representative Holland.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, and this might be for the bill sponsor or for Ms. Wilkerson. I understand that this is to help with reentry for a person. We really want them to make it. They've been doing really well, and we don't want to uproot them from their community. So I'm a little confused about some of the language here because what happens if the prisoner does not have the resources to pay for it? It seems like you may require a prisoner on line 8 by electric monitoring to pay all or a portion, but only if the prisoner has sufficient financial resources to pay the costs. So what does happen if a person is eligible but does not have the resources, and why would, I don't know what it costs, why would the department not pay for that if it's in our best interest to have this person supported so they can re-enter and have the best chance of succeeding and saving us the state dollars?
Through the chair to Representative Vice Chair, this is Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's office. That is a great question. So under A of this section, which is not in your bill, but it is the thing that gives the authority to the commissioner to provide for electronic monitoring with the private contractor. And so they can do it. And if they do, that's what D, you see D here, that's what D says, is if they can't afford it, the cost will be covered. Because we're adding on a new requirement, so that they could do it, and if they're indigent and can't afford the costs, then it would be covered. What this does, this new code section says, is something altogether new. You know, regardless of whether they want to do it or not, they have to do it if the person qualified is in an area like Representative Vance's constituent and is willing to cover it. So it is kind of providing an additional benefit that would be cost. And the truth is, Representative Vance wanted to try to make this a zero fiscal note.
Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson.
For the record, it's April Wilkerson again. Through the chair to Representative Story, we currently do waive some of the fees associated with sentenced electronic monitoring for those individuals that are under the department's contract. And so those are part of the general funds within the sentenced electronic monitoring budget that supports those individuals that are applying for the program, but for whatever reason are unable to pay either the full or a portion of the cost. So the department does provide for those indigent currently, but it's limited to only that area that where we have the resources that are budgeted.
Follow-up? Yes, thank you to the chair. If I could have an idea of what that cost, that would be helpful, but it just does not seem right that we would not try and do that service under what we are doing currently.
Through the chair to Representative Story, Vice Chair Story, our current costs associated with the sentence electronic monitoring that the department currently provides is about $66 to $70 per day per offender. What that cost is on the private provider, we wouldn't know. We would have to go out for bid on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Holland.
Great. Thanks. Through the chair. So I guess I just I want to follow up a little bit on what we just talked about in my earlier questions to make sure I'm clear and correct in what I'm seeing here. First is I'm understanding from what we just have discussed that this electronic monitoring by a private contractor is already allowed and can be done. This just simply says it shall be done. And secondly, this says that the prisoner will pay all the costs, but if the prisoner doesn't have sufficient financial resources, they don't have to. In line 11 and 12, it says if prisoner has sufficient resources, they can pay, but they don't have to. So this sounds to me, but again, correct me if I'm wrong, that this is going to allow a prisoner to live wherever they want to in the state of Alaska. And that could be in a cabin, wherever. It could be in a village community. But they can choose to live wherever they want to in the entire state. And that we will now be, commissioner will be required to provide them a private contractor and monitoring service wherever they reside, if it's outside of an existing area. And that this required payment is still subject to whether or not they have financial resources. So if they don't, they can't be charged for it. So it sounds like we're opening up the door. And so I'm uncomfortable with the amendment right now because what seems like it's taking away some decision-making ability of the commissioner to control the use of this program and the costs that might go with it. So if I'm wrong about either of those assumptions, please correct me, but that's how I'm reading and hearing the discussion we've had so far.
Through the chair to Representative Holland, I absolutely understand where that'd come from. So if you look at D, what this says is other than under E, right? So this is where if they can't afford it, it will be covered because that's what the existing law says. And so the existing law is that if the commissioner chooses to do the electronic monitoring and the person – so it, you know, it does have discretion in there – and the person which they would still have to qualify under B. So the commissioner has to say, yes, this person is qualified. It's not a violent felony, not likely to reoffend. It's safe, you know, all those things. Then and they decide to do electronic monitoring, then they can comp it if the person can't afford it. Under E, it actually wouldn't give them the discretion if they're outside the area and they're required to do it because this code section requires it, then the individual would be required to cover the costs themselves. And so that and that's specifically in E, and E is exempted out of D. I kind of wish the whole code section was in here so you could see A, you could see B with the requirements. It would have made it a longer bill, but it would have maybe gave some more clarity to what this amendment does.
Okay. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, and I think this is for Ms. Wilkerson, and I know you have to be circumspect with your answer, but what does the department think of this? Is this possible, capable? Do you like it? Do you hate it? Is it going to cost a lot more money?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, I did actually have a conversation with the commissioner prior to this hearing, and we're pretty neutral. We understand the circumstances. I know that the commissioner is very adamant that we need partners and we need partnerships. And so I know with her, her goal, and she has actually challenged, given the situation that occurred in Homer, she has challenged staff to identify how can we do business differently, because how can we make success stories happen, because we cannot do it by ourselves.
Follow up. So if you do live in a cabin anywhere in Alaska, in the woods somewhere, of course, where would you go from your cabin in the woods? That would be, but you could see the guy on GPS, right? I mean, so I assume that's how it works, is that he's got a transponder in his little thing and it pings a GPS and tells people where he is. Is that maybe I don't completely understand the EM.
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, there's a couple different types. So there is the GPS tracker, and then there's also the TAD. So if someone has no alcohol, then they may have that device that
that sends a signal when it's reading something different. So if somebody's in their cabin or out fishing because they're a fisherman, then maybe we can utilize a different vendor that has satellite for GPS monitoring, and then we would have them report when they came back to port.
Cool.
Representative Moore. Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, how many offenders do you have on EM currently?
Through the chair to Representative Moore, we have about just under 400 individuals that are on sentenced electronic monitoring currently.
Great. Okay, thank you.
If I may add, we also are currently providing sentenced electronic monitoring in Juneau, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Palmer. There's six locations: Kenai, Palmer, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Ketchikan.
Follow up. And how many vendors do you guys outsource the electronic monitoring through?
Through the chair to Representative Moore, we have one contractor that we are in under contract with for sentenced electronic monitoring, and then our staff are the ones actually doing the supervision. So we rent the equipment, and they provide the monitoring services that our staff then utilize for tracking, reporting, and supervision of that.
Is there additional discussion on Amendment G.3? Seeing none, but sensing that the committee does have some objection, mixed support, and considering that this amendment does require a title change and opens up into this area of electronic monitoring that's not currently in the scope of the bill, I am going to maintain my objection, but I want to echo what Representative Himshute said earlier. This seems like a gap that probably should be addressed in some way, so I would really like to see, either as a standalone bill or as a piece of committee legislation, this concept come forward again. But just recognizing the amount of work that has gone into the underlying bill over the last few years, I would like to potentially see that scope intact for what is currently in the bill. So I'm going to maintain my objection. And seeing no further discussion, I'll have the clerk please call the roll.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Vance, last bite at the apple.
Thank you. This is something that I definitely want to provide. There's been a lot of discussion on this, so I think closing comments on this is warranted. And I appreciate, you know, just being able to have the conversation, but I'm about solving problems. The scope of the bill is to help those be able to have successful reentry to become productive citizens once again. And that's what this amendment is seeking to do, is those who are making a go of it under the electronic monitoring program to be able to stay in the communities where they're receiving support. We have a lot of communities, a lot of people who are trying to reestablish those positive relationships that don't live on the rail belt. They don't live in the main communities of Anchorage, Palmer, Fairbanks, Juneau. And they want to live in a small town, as everybody wants to live in Homer. But it just so happens that this came up because this person is doing so well and then gets the news. The judge said, yes, you can stay in the community. And Department of Corrections said, well, our rules say this. We need you to move 50 miles north because it's more convenient for us. I have take issue with that, and I understand insight in that Homer Police Department is no longer providing the additional oversight. I get that. However, they're still there if there is going to be a violation of parole. And I want to help these people succeed who are truly trying. And I think about how many people that live outside of these main communities who want to just be connected with the people who are going to help them succeed. I understand about dropping a bill. However, this is This is the first and a title change, but this is in the same body as the original bill. I've done the work on this bill previously, so I think the issue is the same. It's helping people reintegrate into our community in a positive way, and we need the partnerships. That's what the tablet's about, is connecting them with educational materials, connecting them with job applications and things like that. This says the commissioner has total oversight, but says, you know what, if they're in their community, that's beyond the reach of what the Department of Corrections can provide on its own right now, we're going to let you do that because you're doing well. But if they don't meet those qualifications, if they violated the parole, the commissioner can say, no, we absolutely need you closer to where we have our resources that can check on you within a short period of time. I don't want to remove the commissioner's discretion to do that, but those who have provided no other cause for interruption of their success, I want to show that we care and we haven't forgotten about them. They haven't gotten lost in the fray, and I think that making this consideration right now is well within the scope of the bill, because that's what we're trying to do. We say, man, we're going to do everything we can to help you succeed. We're not just going to, you know, lock you up and throw away the key. We can be strong on crime and strong on recovery and reentry. So that's what my intent with this is, and I hope that we can do this at the same time without disrupting the whole movement of the bill.
At ease. Say to Representative Vance, I really do appreciate the intent brought forward in this amendment. And having just seen it today myself, that's on me. And I really do hope to explore this concept further. But I do intend to maintain my objection to the amendment. And at this time, can the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
No.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative Himshute.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Chair Carrick.
No.
3A, 4A.
With a vote of 3A's and 4A's, amendment number G.3 is not adopted. And at this time, that brings us to the underlying House Bill 35 as amended. Is there additional discussion on House Bill 35 at this time? Seeing none, I'm going to turn to Vice Chair Story for a motion on House Bill 35.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House Bill 35, also known as 34-LS0355-G, be removed from the House State Affairs Committee as amended with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Object.
There is an objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Himshute.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
4 yea, 3 nay.
On a vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays, House Bill 35 is moved from the State Affairs Committee And we're going to take a brief of these to sign the paperwork. At ease. House State Affairs Committee is back on the record, and finally on our agenda today is House Bill 139 on renting the governor's mansion from Representative Stapp. If Rep. Stapp and your staff, Bernard Aoto, would like to come put yourselves on the record and present the bill, my intention today is to do just an introductory hearing on this legislation and set it aside for consideration at our next hearing, and I will turn it over to the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I'm a member of the State Affairs Committee, and thanks for having me today. For the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp, represent East Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger, and this is my Chief of Staff, Bernard. Bernard?
For the record, Bernard Aoto, Staff to Representative Stapp.
And I'm here today to present House Bill 139, which is an act related to renting the governor's mansion, providing for effective date. So the nucleus behind this bill, it is a very tight title, very kind of obvious the intention. Is basically to start looking at all the different programs that the state does. Many of you know that I do this with a lot of different programs and different bills and looking to change them. This particular bill would look at, the governor's mansion as an asset that we fund currently and try to be innovative in ways to try to make some of these things start to kind of pay for their own expense. So my intention here is, relatively simple. I have no problem. There's other buildings that the legislature owns, the assembly building next door. There's other houses that we own. My objective was really to take some of these expenditures and try to find a way to monetize them to cost us less state money, especially as revenues are lapsing as I speak. I just checked oil price. It's down to $65 a barrel. So I know that you folks don't sit on the Finance Committee, but just so that you know, that is a difference of an already $180 million off the spring revenue forecast that we got about a week ago. So I'll go ahead and turn it over to my Chief of Staff, Bernard, to read the sectional, which is not that in depth. So, Bernard.
For the record, again, Bernard Aoto, and through the chair to the committee, we're going to go over the section. Section 1 basically amends AS44.19, which is covering the Office of the Governor, and adds a new subsection, 44.19.032, which directs that the governor's mansion shall be rented on a short-term basis when the legislature is not in session. It also highlights that during special sessions, that the Office of the Governor can terminate any prearranged contracts if a special session is called, and then gives authorization to the Office of the Governor to establish regulations regarding the rules and fees of such a short-term rental. Section 2 sets it for an immediate effective date, and that is the sectional analysis.
Great. Thank you. And at this time, I'm going to ask our committee aide, Mr. Relay, to come up and do a very quick overview of the fiscal note on this legislation. And after that, we will open it up to committee questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, Staff Representative Carrick. The fiscal note provided for by the Office of Management and Budget, which is in your packets, is an indeterminate fiscal note. The narrative on the back of it is follows, and just reading this into the record, this bill requires the Office of the Governor to rent the governor's mansion on a short-term basis when the legislature is not in session and the governor has not reserved the mansion in advance. The Office of the Governor would be required to adopt regulations and establish a system of making the governor's mansion available for a person or an entity to rent and collect the fee charged for renting the mansion. The fiscal impact of this legislation cannot be determined because the occupancy of the governor cannot reliably be determined in advance, and the mansion must be available for the governor's use on short notice, both during and outside the legislative session. Added costs associated with unsupervised occupancy would include staff time to communicate with the renter, to manage the bookings and to manage access to the building, increased insurance and maintenance costs that includes wear and tear on facility and its furnishings, potential modifications to the historic building to ensure the privacy and security of the residents and staff, and to complete security sweeps after an event or occupancy of the building. Madam Chair, that is the fiscal note. For members' information, the OMB control code is HFZKB, and that is on the bottom here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Relay. We will open it up to questions. I put myself in the queue preemptively, and I wanted to ask the bill sponsor, why limit the legislation to knowing that the governor's mansion must be available on a short-term basis in inside or outside of session? Why limit the scope of the bill to only be rentable during non-session days?
Yeah, for the record, again, Representative Staff to the chair. Excellent question. My intent of the bill was to try to make it as least prescriptive as possible or practicable. I don't necessarily think you have an issue of maybe allowing it to be during legislative session. I want it to be as less disruptive as possible, right? And again, you know, for the record, my intent here is it doesn't have to be an Airbnb. I know everyone calls it the Airbnb bill. It could be something as simple as a day event, like a wedding or something like that, to generate its own DGF funds to be able to pay for itself as practical as possible. But I don't really have an issue if the committee wants to do amendments to the bill and change certain things. Again, the objective here is looking at this monetization of assets. But to the answer to your question is I want it to be as less intrusive or as prescriptive as possible.
And I have a follow-up, and I see a lot of folks have questions. I doubt that this information is kept anywhere, but do we have a sense of how many days both the current and maybe most recent previous couple of governors, how many days of the year they have spent in Juneau at the mansion, just to get a sense of like what the fiscal revenue generation could be from this legislation?
Again, for the record, thank you, Chair Carrick. It varies by kind of governor. Certain governors spend more time in Juneau than other governors, but I will say almost no governor in my lifetime has spent their entire year in Juneau, especially when the legislature's not in session. You'd have to go back a very, very long time to find someone who actually lived in that building full time, let's say in the months of August, September, October, et cetera, you know.
Okay, I will open it up to additional committee questions. I've got a queue going. We'll start with Vice Chair Story.
Thank you. Through the chair to Rep. Stepp. Obvious question to me is when you brought this by to the governor, what was the governor's response and thoughts about it?
Through the chair to the Vice Chair, Representative Story. Well, you know, I've mentioned to him for a couple of years now, to be honest, and everyone who knows me knows that I always try to look for ways to either monetize assets or reduce the budget or cut things, and sometimes those cuts are popular, sometimes they are not popular, but I still attempt them, you know. And this is just one of those other things where I just kind of asked, I said, hey, you know, would you be opposed to, looking at maybe renting out the mansion for a wedding or something like that. And then I'm sure the bill will go through the process and we'll see how it goes. So.
Follow up.
I just wanted to make sure I heard that correctly. The response was put it through the process. We'll see how it goes. Not opposed.
Through the chair to Vice Chair Story. No, that's I can't really remember the exact terminology that the executive used, nor would I probably not want to, you know, reiterate something that I don't know. My interpretation of the remark was just put it through the process, and we'll see how the bill goes.
Thank you.
Moving on to Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So when we did the Legislative Assembly Building, we discussed whether or not to rent it in the off-season, rent the rooms out in the off-season. It was kind of interesting discussion. I think we did two or three different. And at the end of the day, they settled on just if the legislator wanted to store his stuff or her stuff in their
over the interim, they just pay a little bit a month. So it kind of led me to wondering, what about the governor's stuff? Would we be requiring him to take his stuff out, or would we close off his or her room so that nobody could get in there? How would we procedurally do that?
Yeah, Representative McCabe, thanks for the question. And Representative Stafford, for the record, to the chair, Representative McCabe. So this is the entire reason why I left the regulations up to the Office of the Governor, right? Because, I didn't want to be as prescriptive as possible. I would imagine that the Office of the Governor would, write administrative code to determine whether or not they would not do. Again, the objective here is to be as less disruptive as possible. And I think that's probably a sufficient answer.
I don't really have a follow-up. It's kind of an interesting idea. I do have a follow-up. So I think I've already asked your staff if every other state in the country had a governor's mansion. I think all but four or five of them you said do. But the interesting question to me would be, totally forgot what I was going to ask, about would the governor manage this, or would we be managing it? Would somebody else be managing it, OMB managing it, or governor's office? Would he have to add somebody to manage it?
For the record, Bernard Otto, and through the chair to Representative McCabe, to answer your earlier question, so all but five states, Arizona, Idaho, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Rhode Island, have governor's mansion. Those five states do not. And then the states of Alabama, Michigan, New Jersey, and North Carolina actually have two state-owned residences for their executive, with the one being the primary residence and the second being a summer residence or beach house maintained for events. To your second question, the language in the bill allows the Office of the Governor to manage the regulations regarding how the residence can be rented, the fee that's set, and how much it's charged per room per evening, and can also set restrictions on how that house rules, I guess, would be the proper term for that.
Thanks. One more follow-up. Does anybody, through the chair, does anybody else, any other state do this, or are we going to be the scout?
For the record, Bernard Otto, through the chair, to Representative McCabe, in my research, I didn't see that any other state allowed for the executive residence to be rented out in a short-term rental style. However, there are several states that allow the executive residence to be used for special events, receptions. There are restrictions on sort of political fundraising events being held at the residence or any sort of actions like that, but there are several states that do allow a rental fee to be charged for use of the space.
That's interesting. Thanks.
Representative Holland? Maybe not. Representative Moore?
Governor's going to be an entrepreneur.
Going through the queue, Representative Vance.
Thank you. I could have a lot of questions, but I feel like this is to the sponsor of the bill. I just kind of want to harp on the fiscal note for a minute. I know this has been an issue that you have been attacking. I don't know if I have a question, really. Have you pursued their very, very embarrassingly vague fiscal note and asked them why they didn't actually do the work on providing a legitimate fiscal note?
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Vance. Well, so my experience with fiscal notes is sometimes they have a way of saying they might not like your idea by the way they write them, right? I haven't had the chance to have a discussion with OMB regarding it, the Office of the Governor. I will absolutely do that. The fiscal note is relatively new to the bill, didn't have time to do that prior to this hearing. And politely ask them again would be my first approach through the chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. I'm feeling rather cranky about all of the fiscal notes that we've seen, and it's not just this year, but over time, how there's an inconsistency with fiscal notes. And this one, I looked to another historic house here in Juneau that is just a block or two away from the governor's mansion, and that's the Jorgensen House. And they rent their rooms in the summertime anywhere from $645 to nearly $800 a night. So if the office of the governor needed some assistance in how to determine a fiscal note, I think that would be the first place to look. They also offer their place for events. So they could calculate, go a very conservative, moderate number of renting each room for a number of 90 days. And each room could generate around $58,000. Now, it is my understanding that the fiscal note says that it would include staff time to communicate with the renter, more insurance, more this or that. But am I correct that they have full-time staff that are on the premises right now?
For the record, Bernard Otto, through the chair to Representative Vance, you're correct. They have currently the office of the governor in management of the governor's house. And if you look at your bill packets, you'll see the fiscal year 26 OMB budget for the governor's house. And in there, you'll see that $531,100 is allocated for personal services for four permanent full-time year-round positions for a residence manager, personal chef, and two housekeepers.
Follow up. So this fiscal note says that it would be increased insurance and maintenance cost. Does the residents have, I would assume that they have to have insurance just because they have people coming in the residence. Right now, they open it up for Christmas time for cookies, and they have people of the public. Wouldn't this insurance cover people coming in on a short-term basis?
Got it. Thank you again for the record, Representative Staff, through the chair to Representative Vance. It depends on how they would craft the regulations, right? They certainly have the building insured already. One does have to kind of beg the question is what exactly does the chef do in the summertime if they're a full-time employee when no one's there? And I said this isn't really the case with this governor. I mean, I don't think anyone's lived – maybe I'll defer to our member from Juneau here on the panel. I don't think anyone governor has lived in the mansion for all 365 days a year. So,
Madam Chairman, just for the record, I'm a traditionalist. I don't want to rent out the governor's mansion, but I do want to press on the governor's office about providing legitimate fiscal notes so that we can make an informed decision. I don't care if it's something that sounds like a new idea, like renting the governor's mansion. I need the information at hand, and doing just a little bit of work can provide a pretty sound fiscal note. And I'm seeing this consistently on legislation. And so I want to take a moment to encourage the governor's office in every department. Help us help you. We want to pass good policy. We want to solve these fiscal decisions. But when they're absolutely vague, it makes it feel like they spent maybe 5 minutes to write it. And here we are trying to make informed decisions, and I feel like our hands are tied behind our backs because we have to beg them for a legitimate and up-to-date fiscal note. Thank you for letting me rant on this for a moment, but I think this is the key to whether or not this legislation would have any forward motion at all, is if we could find out what's really involved in this decision. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that. And even though the State Affairs Committee is not usually the committee that's reviewing fiscal notes really closely, I did want to read that fiscal note statement into the record today because I would agree that was an inadequate fiscal note statement. Doesn't allow us to make a lot of informed decisions on fiscal impact. We are essentially out of time today. I do see that there are a lot of questions, or there are a few questions. We are bringing this bill back up on Thursday, and so we will have more time then.
Perfect.
I'm going to turn it to Vice Chair Story for the last comment, and then we're going to set the bill aside.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, for allowing me to make a comment. I have to say that as a representative who serves in the capital city, I am very, and I believe everyone is here, very proud, too, of our Capitol building, our Capitol complex. The governor's house is very historic. It is something that I want to see treated as a historic residence. And so I think it would be very important to protect the investment the state has in that particular piece of our history. And I would I'm really hesitant. And I want the governor, from whatever year, whatever, feels so welcome in this city and is really respected for their work and care. And I just am hesitant. I want them to be able to come, him or her, anytime and make sure that things are all set up and raring to go. So I'm very hesitant to move in this direction.
Well, thank you for those comments. And again, we will have a chance to discuss the bill more on Thursday this week. So stay tuned for that. And that concludes House State Affairs for today. Our next meeting is on Thursday, April 10th at 3:15. At that meeting, we will be taking up the following bills. Public testimony on House Bill 104, that's the address confidentiality program from Representative Mears that we heard today, as well as public testimony on this bill, House Bill 139, from Representative Stapp. And then we will probably spend the bulk of our hearing Thursday considering amendments on House Bill 16, campaign contribution limits, from Representative Shragi. And with no further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 5:03.